meetings this year at Holden Village this week are a study of the Gospel of Luke, and we're entitling it Jesus and Jubilee. I'll tell you why that's our title a little later. The program is in front of you. Today we're going to be dealing with the first four verses of chapter 1 to set down an orderly account, said the writer of the gospel. Tomorrow we'll be looking at Jesus' first sermon in his home synagogue in Nazareth in chapter 4 of Luke 16 through 30 to proclaim the Lord's favor. And here we'll meet the Jubilee theme directly. On Wednesday, chapter 6, what is sometimes called the Sermon on the Level. It's, as you know, a parallel to Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount. And we're looking at the term, blessed are you who are poor. And on Thursday, what we call the Lord's Prayer in chapter 11, verses 1 through 3. And our emphasis is on the petition, your kingdom come. And then on Friday, we'll be looking at some selections from what is a unique portion of the Gospel of Luke, not to be found in any of the other three Gospels, namely the section between 9:51 and 18:14, the beginning of the journey toward Jerusalem, when Jesus set his face to go to Jerusalem. And we'll be taking some selected parables from that portion, parables that are found only in the Gospel of Luke. And the theme is, then he told them a parable. That's our menu for the week. If any of you will be here all week, this is the preview of coming attractions. Any questions or comments about that? Now, I'd like to begin by finding out what we already know about the Gospel of Luke. What do you know about the Gospel of Luke? I'm going to put you on the blackboard as soon as you talk. Blackboard, whiteboard.
Well, it has a pretty familiar story called Christmas.
Yes, yeah, in the days of Caesar Augustus, all were enrolled, and Mary and Joseph going to Bethlehem is found in the Gospel of Luke,
right?
And only in the Gospel of Luke. Christmas story. Well, there is a Christmas story in one of the other Gospels, right? Which one? Anyway. In Matthew. What's the difference between the two stories? Do you know? Everything is different between the two stories. They're just not similar at all. The Christmas story in Luke is told from Mary's perspective. While the story in Matthew is told, you might say, from Joseph's perspective. He's the one who finds out his girlfriend is pregnant, and what do I do now? And he's decided to break up the relationship, and the angel comes and talks to Joseph. That's in Matthew. And then the Magi story, the wise men, that's in Matthew. That's not in Luke at all. In fact, the two stories are not at all similar. They're very different from each other. When we put on our Christmas pageants in our church, we combine them. We have the shepherds, and they wear burlap, and we have the wise men, and they wear beautiful robes. When I was a kid, I always wanted to be a wise man, and I never got to be a wise man. So I'm standing in front of you as one who's deprived of being a wise man. I guess that's why I went to graduate school, to try to be a wise man. Okay, the Christmas story in the second chapter of Luke, and ahead of that, of course, is the story of Elizabeth, who becomes pregnant with, who is her son?
John.
John becomes called John the Baptist. And Zechariah, her husband, who is struck dumb. Remember that story? That's in the first chapter. And in the second chapter, the familiar Christmas story that we read every Christmas. Okay, what else do you know about the Gospel of Luke? Anybody? This is school now. Don't raise your hand.
Well, it's later than Mark.
Later than Mark?
Later than
all right.
But I forgot where it comes in relation to Matthew.
Okay, we'll get to that. Let's just say now it's dependent upon Mark. We really need to put all of these names in parentheses because we don't know that, not parentheses, but quotation marks, because we don't know that Mark was the author of Mark or Luke was the author of Luke. But we'll use these terms. We're familiar to put that. But the whole question of authorship is one that scholars spend a lot of time talking about. But it is true that the Gospel of Luke is dependent upon what we call the Gospel of Mark. And we'll say more about that later this hour. Anything else you know about Luke?
The crucifixion story is a criminal that comes to faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
Found only in Luke.
Okay. You're thinking about the thief on the cross.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Do you know anything about the man Luke, who is presumed to be the author of this gospel?
Well, he's a doctor.
Physician.
All right, he's believed to be a physician. That's one of the presumptions, and we'll see in a minute why that legend or theory has developed. Anything else about him?
And as a result, does Luke contain a lot of the healing accounts?
A lot of healing. That goes with the physician idea, right? That's true. There's a lot of healing stories in the Gospel of Luke.
Is it Greek?
Greek? It's been believed by many that Luke was a Greek, yes. And that he was a Gentile.
Gentile Jew.
Pardon me?
A Gentile, not a Jew.
Yeah. Gentile means simply the nations. It's the meaning of the word. And it was the way in which Jewish people talked about everybody else. There are Jewish people and then there are all the rest of them. And it's a long-standing tradition that Luke was a Gentile. And if so, he's the only Gentile author of any of the books of the Bible. All the rest of the Bible written by Jews, as far as we know.
And I think Matthew wrote to his people, the Hebrew people, for them, and Luke wrote to the wider world, and going all the way back to Adam instead of.
That's right. That goes along with the idea that Luke was a Gentile. He seems to write to a Gentile audience. We won't spend a lot of time on that, but we'll see some indications of that already in what we're looking at. Certainly before the week's over, this will come out.
It's reported he's the author of Acts.
Yeah. Ah, good, yes. Believed that Luke was also the author of the book Acts of the Apostles. And I'll show you some things this morning that relate to that theory. Oh, great, we got a good board full of stuff here. Anything else you just really want to say about
Luke is the only gospel that contains the story of the road to Emmaus.
About what?
Luke is the only gospel that contains the story of the Emmaus account.
The Emmaus...
You got people here from Emmaus Lutheran Church, so we had to bring that up.
Good for you. The post-resurrection.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Did you know that the Gospel of Mark doesn't have any post-resurrection stories? If we only had the Gospel of Mark, we wouldn't know anything about post-resurrection stuff. Well, good. That's a good way to start, to have all of that in front of us. I'd like to say some things about the authorship of the Gospel of Luke now, and some of that will repeat what we've already said, but that's okay. First, to note that the idea that Luke and Acts are written by the same person, and now if you have Bibles, let's look at the first four verses of the Gospel of Luke, which is our assignment for today, according to the menu on the board. You all know where Luke is. It's the third book in the New Testament, right? Matthew, Mark, Luke. There was a canon in the ancient world that had, Matthew first and John second, and then Luke, and then Mark. I'm not sure, those two. On the theory that Matthew and John were both disciples of Jesus, and Mark and Luke were disciples of disciples, or disciples of apostles. Mark being a disciple of Paul, Luke, a disciple of Paul. but that's not the way we traditionally arrange the canon. We usually think Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So it's often called the third gospel. All right? You found it? Who can read it for us? Somebody read it, please.
Since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed on to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, I too decided, after investigating everything carefully from the very first, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the truth concerning the things about which you have been instructed.
Very good, thank you. Now, will you keep your finger on that passage and turn to the first verses of the Acts of the Apostles, which is the fifth book in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts. And would somebody read the first two verses, I think, would read two verses, the first two verses.
In the first book, Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus did and taught from the beginning until the day when he was taken up to heaven after giving instructions through the Holy Spirit to the apostles whom he had chosen.
Good. Now, what do you see? What do you see when you put these two readings side by side?
Both addressed to Theophilus.
They're both addressed to somebody called Theophilus. And what else do you see?
He refers to his first letter.
The first
which
book.
Would be in Luke then.
Right, yeah. He talks about the first book. So common understanding is, and there's really no controversy about this among scholars, is that these two books were written by the same person, and the Gospel of Luke covers generally the life of Jesus, from about 4 B.C., it's generally believed that Jesus was born before Christ. Seems a bit strange that our calendar is off by about 4 years. Jesus was born probably the year 4 B.C., died somewhere around 30, what we call A.D. or Common Era CE, and that the Book of Acts covers the next generation, so to say, the next 30 years or so, from roughly 30 to the death, well, not quite. Paul hasn't died yet, but the death of Paul, roughly, approximately 60, 64, 65, somewhere in there. So 30, to, the gospel between 4 BC and 30, and the Book of Acts between 30 and 64. The Book of Acts being the first chapter in church history. First chapter in the history of the church. What happened the first generation after the life of Jesus? That this person, Luke, whoever he was, decided to set down an orderly account of, after careful investigation, he tells us, very, very careful investigation, he's setting down an orderly account of the life of Jesus and of what happened among some of the apostles, certainly not all of them, in the next generation. And all of this is addressed to Theophilus. Now, who is Theophilus? Anybody know?
He's a lover of God.
The name means Theos, Philos, one who loves God, or one who's loved by God. You could translate it either way. Well, good for you. Nobody knows who he was.
He probably was a Greek, though, with that name.
It's a Greek name, yes. And that's another thing that contributes to the argument that Luke was a Gentile writing to Gentiles, writing to Greeks. That the presumed recipient of this material is someone with a Greek name. Now, that's not conclusive, however, because by the time Luke lives, which is in the third, or by the time the Gospel of Luke's being written, in the third of the first century, sometime after 75 or so, the whole Mediterranean world was Greek. The culture of that world was Greek. Having followed the exploits of Alexander the Great, who conquered the whole Mediterranean world and introduced what we often call Hellenistic influence, Greek influence over that whole area. And the common language of the people by the time of Luke is writing is is Greek. It's not the classical Greek of Plato and Aristotle. It's what's called Koine Greek, or Common Greek. It's a little bit rugged as compared to classical Greek. So the Greek scholars, I'm not one of them, tell us. It's sort of like
American English.
Yeah, English and English. American English and English. It's sort of like Brooklynese, maybe. As compared to a fine English spoken by the Queen. But that was the language of that era, and that's the reason. Reason why the New Testament is written in the Greek language, because that was the language of that period. Even the Hebrew scriptures, what Christians call the Old Testament, which of course is the only Bible that Jewish people know, even that was translated into Greek by the time Jesus lived. Did you know that? The Hebrew Bible was translated into what was called the Septuagint. I think I should put that word up here. Book. The Septuagint. That translation was made, well, I think it's about 100 years before Jesus lived. And sometimes you'll find when it's referred to by the Roman number 70. The interesting legend back of the Septuagint is that 70 scholars were brought together to translate the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. And they all worked separately from each other. And when they came together and compared their translations, they were exactly alike. Exactly alike. Don't believe that, because it's a bit of a hairy theory, but that's the notion back of the Septuagint. So that when the gospel writers quote the Old Testament, they quote from the Septuagint. And that's one reason why sometimes if you look at a quotation in the gospel that's presumed to be a quotation from, say, one of the prophets in the Old Testament, you will, if you compare what you have in Matthew, for example, Matthew does this a lot. Luke doesn't do it as often. Matthew writes to a Jewish audience, as you said, and so he uses the Old Testament quotations a lot to prove his point, to prove that Jesus fulfills the prophecies. Luke does it very, very seldom. I think there are only two or three places where he cites the Old Testament. But when the Old Testament is cited by the gospel writer, you'll sometimes see that there's some difference between the text that you have in your English Bible in the Old Testament and what you have in the gospel. And one reason for that is that they're quoting from the Septuagint. They're quoting from a translation. So what you have in the English Bible is a translation of a translation of a translation, and who knows how many translations before it kind of finally gets into our scripture. So the world of that time was very Greek, and so the name Theophilus, and even the name Luke, which is, after all, a Greek name too, and Mark is a Greek name, Marcus. But Mark was quite certainly Jewish. He was called John Mark in the book of Acts. John being a Hebrew name and Mark being a Greek name. And very often in the ancient world, people would have both Hebrew, or Jewish people would have both Jewish and Greek names. They had a Jewish name they used when they were with their Jewish friends, and they had a Greek name they used in the general public when they were doing business or commerce or whatever. And a good example of that is Saul Paul, you know, who Saul was his Hebrew name, and then when he became a Christian, he took the name Paul, Paulus, a Greek name. Saul meant mighty, power, proud, King Saul, you know, great king. And Paulus means small and insignificant, and he presumably preferred to be known by a name that didn't carry all of that majestic connotation that the name Saul had after he became a Christian. And he recognized himself as being, as he says in one place, the chief of sinners, the chief of sinners, and standing in the need of God's forgiveness as he lives, and regretting the terrible life of persecuting the believers in Jesus prior to his becoming a Christian himself. So these names are not altogether conclusive, but it is an interesting indication of what we have already noted, that Luke may well be a Gentile writing to Gentiles. But at any rate, you have that same reference at the beginning of both Luke and Acts. Now, there are some reasons for believing that the writer was the person we know as Luke. In the book of Acts, turn with me to chapter 16. In Acts, now. And verse 10. Now just read for yourself and see if you notice what happens when you reach verse 10. compare it, for example, to verse 6. When you get to verse 10 and 11 and through that next section, what happens to the narrative?
Goes from A to B.
Goes from third person to the first person, right? They so-and-so-and-so-and-so, and now when you get to verse 10, it's we so-and-so-and-so. And in verse 11, we set sail from Troas. On the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate by the river. We sat down. Next verse, God was listening to us, and that continues through a good deal of the rest of this narration about Paul's travels, as though what you have is somebody who was there with Paul, traveling with him. And then if you compare that to Colossians chapter 4, verse 14, Colossians is one of Paul's letters, of course. Who will read that out loud, the first person who finds it?
The beloved physician, excuse me, and Demas greet you.
Okay, Paul is writing to the Colossians, and he brings greetings from Luke, the beloved physician. Here's evidence that Luke was indeed traveling with Paul, and that he was, as we've already said, a physician. That's the basis for that theory. Look again at Philemon, that little book that comes right after Hebrews. It's only one chapter long. Verses 23 and 24. And who's going to find it first?
Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Christ Jesus, sends greetings to you, and so do Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, and Luke, my fellow workers.
All right, good. There's another indication that Luke is with Paul, right? And Paul is bringing greetings from this series of people. And just to get one more, 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 11. You can find that one.
Which Timothy was that?
Second.
Only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful in my ministry.
Right, and if you read ahead of that a little bit, you'll find that Paul is complaining because he's been abandoned by most of his friends. And then he says, only Luke is with him. And who else?
Get Mark and bring him with you.
Mark, yeah. The person that the Gospel of Mark is attributed to. Now, this passage is not really conclusive because most scholars do not think 2 Timothy was written by Paul. So that may not help us very much. But the other two, Colossians most certainly was written by Paul. So we have the person of Luke tied up with Paul as one of his traveling companions, and possibly that's why we have the first person pronoun used in part of the narration. Though again we're not conclusive, because it's possible that the writer of Luke, the Gospel of Luke, whoever he was using materials of various kinds and was simply putting them into his text without doing a lot of editing. You understand? You follow that reasoning? Yes, please.
Paul was a Roman Jew, and would it be assumed that Luke was a Roman citizen in the Greek world? Would one assume that? I don't know what citizenship for Greeks was.
I don't know. That's a good question. I really don't know the answer to it. I don't think you could assume that. I don't think you could assume citizenship. Roman citizenship, as I understand it, was a very special honor that was given to certain people of great distinction. Mm. And what it does, when Paul says, I'm a Roman citizen. What that does indicate is something of Paul's aristocratic background. And at some point in his life, someone had done something heroic. Someone in his family, probably not Paul himself, had done something that caused him to be given honorary citizenship in Rome. And Paul inherited that very likely from a forebear. We don't know that, of course, but that's the probably.
When we speak of Luke as a Greek, are we speaking of that as a citizen Greek, or are we speaking of that as a Greek-minded person who could be of any nationality?
It would be an ethnic term.
Ethnic Greek.
Yeah. Okay. That it would mean that he was not, if we say he's Greek, or more accurately, if we say he's Gentile, it would mean that he's not Jewish.
Yeah.
He's not ethnically a Jew.
Okay.
He's not circumcised. He's not part of the Jewish. Mm-hmm. A descendant of Abraham and Sarah and the Jewish line.
Okay.
Any questions so far? I like to stop and find out what's happening. That's good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now, a question, is Luke a Gentile? Let's just look at that for a minute. As we've already said, he seems to have a Gentile, not a Jewish audience in mind. And one of the indications of that is that he has very few quotations from the Old Testament. He's not writing to people for whom the Hebrew Scriptures are familiar. When Matthew writes, it's pretty clear that Matthew understands that his readers know the Old Testament. And in an age when most people were illiterate, people knew their Bible a whole lot better than we do. They memorized it. And all Matthew would have to do is make a citation and the people would know immediately about it. Just as when you talked about the Christmas story from Luke, everybody knew what you were talking about, because that's familiar. And in among the Jewish people, the Old Testament would be very familiar, the Old Testament prophets. But Luke doesn't do that. That's not his way of arguing. and likewise, he seldom argues from Old Testament prophecy in the way that Matthew does. And one other really interesting thing, it seems to me, is that when Luke refers to Jesus, he never uses the word rabbi. Well, Matthew uses that word frequently, that the people identify Jesus as a rabbi. Luke uses a word that's much more characteristically Greek when he calls Jesus master, a master, instead of rabbi. Interesting, isn't that kind of fun? To get those kinds of insights into the writer. And then the other thing that scholars tell us about is that the Greek that Luke uses is really a very splendid Greek. Now, I don't know Greek well enough to be able to say that in my own research, but that it's beautiful. It's beautifully done. Mark has again kind of a Brooklynese Greek. It's very rugged and fast moving. Luke's Greek is very smooth and very lovely, very classical. and some people have called the Gospel of Luke the most beautiful book in the world. So that's what we're going to spend our time on this week, the most beautiful book in the world. Now, let's do something else that will help us to see how the Gospel of Luke came to be written, and we're going to get back to this observation that one of you made, that the Gospel of Luke is dependent on the Gospel of Mark. And I'm looking for an eraser. Oh, we use it. Are you familiar with many of you are, I'm sure, with the term that's used to classify the first three Gospels.
Synoptic.
First three Gospels are called the Synoptic Gospels. Synoptic. As distinguished from the Gospel of John. And the reason why they're called that is because the Greek word synoptic means to view together, to see together. We divide, like you do with most Greek words, you divide it into two parts. Optic, you know that word means eyes, see, kuria. Familiar with that? And sun in Greek means with, to see with. The idea is that the first three Gospels have a lot of commonality. They seem to look at the life of Jesus in a way that's very similar. While the Gospel of John is much, much different from the other three, sometime when you want to check that out, just read the four Gospels, and you'll see that very clearly. While we can draw some contrast between the Synoptic Gospels, as we have already between Mark, Matthew, and Luke, yet it's true that these three Gospels are generally, broadly, very similar. So they're called the Synoptic Gospels. Now, it's believed by scholars that there's a relationship between them as to how they were written. And the theory that was developed decades ago has managed to sustain itself now for a long, long time. I learned this theory when I was in seminary 100 years ago. I was in seminary in the early 50s at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, and we learned about what's called the synoptic problem from one of my very favorite teachers in my whole life, Warren Quanbeck. Any of you know Warren Quanbeck? Marvelous, marvelous man. And theories don't last that long, usually, even in biblical studies, and certainly not in scientific studies. My wife Judy is a scientist, and those theories get moved around a lot. So this is a pretty amazing how this theory has held up. Let me give that theory to you. The theory is that Mark is the oldest of the four Gospels, written probably 65 AD, sometime before 70. 70 is a crucial date because that's the date in which the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans. And both Matthew and Luke borrow significantly from Mark. But that there's another source from which both Matthew and Luke borrow, and that source has disappeared. And it's called by the letter Q. Why? Because in German, where this theory arose, the word for source is Quelle. So it's simply called source. In our language, I suppose we put an S there, but we scholars all use the word Q, for the letter Q. And that both Mark, Matthew, and Luke borrowed from Q as well. In the meantime, Matthew had some distinctive material that he used, and Luke had some distinctive material that he used. Good example are the birth narratives that we've already talked about. Matthew got that material from a source other than Mark and Q. And Luke got his story from somewhere other than Mark and Q.
What are the years for Matthew and Luke?
Matthew and Luke would be sometime 75, 85. Those dates, scholars don't agree on those dates. Well, the Gospel of John was probably written as late as 100. It comes significantly later than the Synoptic Gospels. That's the theory. Now, I'm not going to try to argue that theory fully, but just to give you a few little insights into why this construct has been developed by the scholars to show the background of these three Gospels. Mark has very little, that is not in either Matthew or in Luke. Almost all of Mark is duplicated in either Matthew or Luke, not by both of them, but one or the other of them. When Mark and Matthew differ, on the sequence of events, Luke agrees with Mark. I said that wrong. I'm not sure I copied this down right. When Mark and Matthew differ on sequence, Luke agrees with Mark. That's right. Luke agrees with Mark.
Makes sense.
Not with Matthew. Mm-hmm. I did say it right. And when Mark and Luke differ on sequence, Matthew agrees with Mark. Matthew and Luke never agree on sequence against Mark. Another little indication, Luke uses 60% of Mark, and that 60% equals about one-third of Luke's gospel. About one-third of Luke's gospel comes almost directly out of Mark. Sometimes the words are changed, the phrasing may be changed, but sometimes it's verbatim. It's very obvious that it's copied from a previous account. It's generally believed that Q was had a lot of the sayings of Jesus in it, a lot of the parables. And we don't know that. So there's a lot of scholarly writing trying to reconstruct Q. And there's not a lot of agreement about that. But there is very definitely agreement among scholars on this basic scheme of things. And I thought you might be interested.
How do you answer those who ask about inspiration? Luke was inspired by God.
Yeah.
And typical interpretation of inspiration is that God moves the writer to write, instead of that he copies.
Well, that's a tough one. The old theory that many of us were raised on is that the writer, the biblical writer, was simply a kind of a secretary who was taking dictation from God. I remember seeing a picture that had a hand with a pen in it, and God was directing this hand. I don't believe that. I don't know whether you do. I don't think that can be borne out in a study of the scriptures. If you hold to that theory, and obviously fundamentalists do, that's what makes a fundamentalist a fundamentalist, basically, is that idea that the Bible is in every word, commas and periods, in place, dropped out of heaven, as it were. I think that just cannot be maintained if one does a serious critical study of the Bible. And this kind of scheme begins immediately, as you're suggesting, raises serious questions about that whole notion of what, quote, inspiration means.
But cannot someone be inspired by God by being inspired by the writings of another and then expand upon those writings? Can't that all be, inspiration from God?
this is, excuse me, what I was about to say, that the word inspiration, the word inspiration means simply in the spirit, inspiration. And to say that the biblical writer was in the spirit or was moved by the spirit is quite possible, even if we deal with the various inconsistencies that are in the scriptures. If you look at the two temptation narratives where Jesus was tempted, just to give you one little example, and compare Matthew and Luke, you'll find that they're in different order. Have you noticed that? I can't give that to you now, but do that sometime. Look at the temptation story. Now, it had to be one or the other. It couldn't be both, because they're obviously different from each other. If you compare the history of Israel that's in 1 and 2 Kings with the history of Israel that's in 1 and 2 Chronicles, and it's covered, the same material is covered, the same history is covered in both, you find very significant differences in timing. Not in sequence so much, but in the years. When I first started teaching Bible as a 28-year-old faculty member at Augustana College, I tried very hard to bring all of that stuff into sequence and pattern. I gave up after a while. It's impossible. It's impossible. Take the birth narratives. You know, there are all kinds of problems when you try to put the birth narratives inside of each other. We can do it in our Christmas pageants easily enough. But if you sit down and try to write a birth narrative based on those two birth narratives, I promise you, you've got problems. Try it sometime. It's not easy. So what we have in the scriptures is a writer who is wrestling with this material. As Luke says in the beginning of his gospel, I have investigated this material, I've worked with it, I'm trying very, very hard to understand it, and I'm trying to convey it to you in a way that will make it possible for you to know the truth, that you will be able to know the truth. Please.
In your selected account here, it says that he went out and carefully worked to find an orderly account. I mean, it sounds like he is definitely not a first-person receiver like Matthew or John would have been reported to have been, and so he has to gather. I mean, it's just naturally he has to gather information from others.
Right.
Just
right.
Has to be that way.
Yep. That's right. He makes no claim to be an eyewitness.
Yeah. None. In the Missouri Synod, I think, I'm not sure, that they would go along with the synoptic aspect, but not the Q aspect, officially, the top leaders. I don't think they teach the Q.
No.
Oh. I think they understand the synoptic or agree with but that is only true of the official teaching.
I don't know that.
Yeah.
Whether that's so or not.
Yeah, I think that's
possible.
I think it's true.
Well, let's say a little more about that. The material we have in the Gospels goes through an evolution, if you will. We have the events, the first generation in the Gospel and the second generation in Acts, as I've already said. And then we have what's called the oral tradition. The stories of the events were told orally. And then we have the written material. And then we have the Gospels as we know them now. And if you look carefully at those first four verses, as you've already done, apparently, in Luke, you'll see that he says that. He cites all four of those stages. Look at that again, to be sure we have it in front of us. first chapter of Luke. Many have undertaken to set down an orderly account. Many have. Lots of people have written. So you've got lots of written stuff that's happened. And what are they setting down? An orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us. That as they were handed on to us, that word in Latin is traditio. We get our word tradition. The tradition is that which is handed down from one generation, like a relay race, handed down from one generation to another. These events have been handed down to us and written down, and now I've been working with that stuff. I've been working with these written accounts. I've been talking to people. I've done a lot of detective work and snooped around to find out what's going on. And now I've written down what is true, what you can believe. And the word truth here is one I've done a little research on. It's kind of interesting. Usually in the English Bible, the word truth is the translation of a Greek word that is really a philosophical word. When Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and what would be another place? When Pilate says, what is truth? there are several. The Gospel of John uses that word a lot. What it means is, what is ultimate reality? What is absolutely the case? What is that there that's out there that you can depend upon, that you can have confidence in, that's reliable? Understand? This word, truth, is more, I'm going to call it a legal word. It's like, and again, it's a more Greek word. The first word, aletheia, means, is much more a Jewish kind of word. Jewish people think that way. The Hebrew writer thinks in terms of metaphysics, reality, while the Greek wants to nail it down. And the Greek, the word that Luke uses here means just that you can nail it down. It comes from a Greek verb that means literally to nail it down, to secure it, to fasten it firmly. See how Greek that is?
He's not guaranteeing that every word that he's writing is true.
Well, I don't know how much he's saying.
I mean, in our own Missouri Synod, we have a controversy, because if not every word that Luke has written is verifiable, and deemed true, then the whole thing can be thrown out. So what is the ultimate truth is what you're getting at, and that's Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's the way aletheia is understood. But that's not the word that Luke
uses. You're
saying
this is more a true-false, like he's saying this
that's
is
correct.
True.
Yes,
yeah,
it's true-false.
To truth, yeah.
This is
the right... Yeah,
it's fact. It's factual. It's actual, factual. And that's a different... Do you understand the nuance here? That's a different kind of understanding of truth. The King James Version uses the word certainty. Maybe it's a good thing that the King James Version doesn't use the word truth here. I think it's confusing if we use the word truth, because that's the word truth is used quite differently elsewhere in the New Testament. Has a different kind of meaning. As I said, this is kind of a preliminary little piece of research I've done this summer in preparation for these studies. And I found it very fascinating. I think it may be another indication of the Greek orientation of this gospel, as contrasted certainly with the Gospel of John, that uses the aletheia notion of truth all the time. It's there a dozen or more times.
I just want to say something about oral tradition. You can see that in the Acts, in the early sermons, which the apostles did, that's the beginning of oral tradition.
Yeah.
Now, those may not be verbatim accounts, but they do tell the gospel story in essence. Then, of course, each Sunday they assemble for the Lord's Supper, when they would review the events again. That was orally done over many, many years. And people who were close to Jesus but not apostles, the women especially, I'm thinking of, witness to the resurrection and the other events, they did a lot of talking, remembering, passing on their stories to their children, grandchildren, and so on. That was oral tradition.
Good, yeah. Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? Something happens, you've experienced something. Think of those 12 disciples or those women at the resurrection. Wow, you can't keep still. You got to tell that. You tell it. And remember, I think it's important to remember that most people were illiterate in this period. And so they didn't rely on written stuff. Most of the information that people got was oral. Our practice of reading the texts as a part of Sunday morning is a good indication of that. That goes way back into the synagogues. We'll see tomorrow when Jesus makes his first sermon in the synagogue, he reads from Isaiah, just like we read. If you were at the service last night, we read the three texts for the sign for the day. And most of the people didn't have that text in front of them. They didn't know how to read. They had to remember that. And that's sort of the background that we kind of lose sight of in our book world where we live.
I ask a detective sometime about eyewitness accounts.
Right. Eyewitness accounts don't always agree to it. Right.
Never.
Oral tradition does not mean a laxed tradition of passing on information.
No.
It can be very rigid.
Yes.
And it's very accurate. I heard of a professor once who had a group of seminarians who didn't believe the accuracy of it, and so he lay down and said, "Well, what scripture do you want me to quote?" And they looked at him and they said something, and so he began to quote from memory that in English. And then he said, "Well, let's do it in Hebrew now." And he began to do it in Hebrew, and then he did it in Greek. And he had learned that, and that was extremely accurate. So, I mean, my brain can't do that,
no.
Or could, but I mean, I have a skill to do that.
But we're not trained to do that.
Yeah, but that is, so once they got locked into their form, mm-hmm. then it was probably passed on perfectly, but it had to be locked into some form somehow. I don't know that how. So it isn't laxed in any way.
No, we don't mean to indicate by this that it's sloppy.
Yeah.
It's
But storytellers tend to embellish. You hear the story, but then when you repeat it, you like to maybe give a little bit of your kick to it.
Right.
So as it goes down, the basic part of it certainly will tend to go along, but it may get some additional bits here and there.
There's an inclination to do that, yes. I haven't quite finished what I wanted to do this morning. I wanted to point out that the approach we're going to take to the Gospel of Luke this week is an economical one. And what I'd like to have you do, if you have time this week, is to read through the Gospel of Luke or scan it and find all the places where money is talked about, or poverty, or wealth. And I put a little dollar sign next to that in my Bible. And it's just absolutely amazing how frequently money is talked about in this gospel. And we're going to come back to that in the next days and see what that means, if there's anything here that can help us in thinking about money. Tomorrow we're going to look at a videotape that we produced in St. Paul, Minneapolis with Dr. Sarah Henrich from Luther Seminary, who's done two 20-minute video presentations on the Jubilee idea that we find in the fourth chapter of Luke. So please come back and we'll spend some time thinking that one through. Thank you. Turn off the table.